Good morning, beloved brethren and sisters, in the bonds of the Abrahamic covenant. I bring with me the love and the greetings of the brethren and sisters of the Hengoi Ecclesia, those who were not able to make the trip with us, those of us who could. So greetings from the brethren and sisters of those who are behind in Hengoi, who are thinking of you all and remembering you particularly at this time. It's difficult for us to imagine, in the quietness that we are experiencing now, and even in the humdrum of our daily lives, it's kind of difficult for us to imagine the clash of sword and spear, the terrifying shrieks and cries of horsemen, and the armies of opposing sides as they come together, and the swords clash, and the horses and their prancing and their neighings as they charge into battle, and the chariots as they pour forward with great speed to destruction and to the obliteration of the opponent. It's difficult to imagine the vast and copious amounts of blood that would pour forth from severed limbs and arteries and soak into the parched earth. That's what the book of Joshua was all about. The destruction of Israel's enemies, the destruction of Yahweh's enemies, and the cleansing of the land from those putrefying nations, from those godless Canaanites who had filled up the measure of their iniquity. The period of the judges reversed some of that. In the period of Joshua, there was victory after victory after victory. It's a greatly encouraging book, isn't it, when we go through the book of Joshua. Despite the repeated efforts of the Canaanites, they were unable to defeat the children of Israel, who retained their fidelity to Yahweh. The book of Judges presents us with the opposite picture. The period of the Judges reminds us more of defeat and disastrous times for the people of Israel. The period of the judges is a far cry from Deuteronomy 32, where it says, one shall chase 1,000 and two shall chase 10,000. This is the very reverse. The children of Israel became subject to the nations that were left in the land. The land had rest, as Brother Pat concluded his reading for us this morning. The land had rest 40 years. Of course, the land didn't really need to rest, did it? Well, yes, it did, in accordance with the Leviticus 25 verse 4. Every 7 years there was a Sabbath, and the land had rest for very good reasons and typical reasons as well. But as far as the warfare that was concerned, the land could have soaked up probably a few thousand more gallons of blood without too much effect. The phrase, the land had rest, seems to conjure up in my mind, I don't know what it does for you, but it seems to have this effect that it had rest from war. But it was the people on the land that really had the rest. The land was inanimate. It was the land with inhabitants upon it that had the rest. Why should it have been this way? Or, to put the question another way, perhaps, was it God's purpose that there would be warfare. Was this the land flowing with milk and honey that had been promised to the children of Israel? Was this the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 28, Yahweh shall make thee the head and not the tail? Israel, in the period we're looking at, were not really receiving the benefits of a land flowing with milk and honey. They were not really receiving the benefits of being the subject and the prominent nation. They were now very much the tail, as we've been considering in the last couple of days when we've been looking at the book of Judges. Joshua had made it possible for the children of Israel to inherit the land. He'd gone forth with courage and vigor and with a steadfast determination to rout the Canaanites. And he had broken the back of the resistance in the north, in the south, and in the central parts of the land. But there was still much land to possess. As it's recorded, there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. Joshua 13 verse 1. And Brother Jim on Monday drew our attention to the initial chapters of the book of Judges, where it says, these are the nations that Yahweh left to prove whether the children of Israel would hearken unto God's commandments. So we have a situation where the main resistance, the power block of Canaan, had been broken. But there was still much to do. And as we've been discussing, Brother Jim really sort of laid the foundation for us and started us thinking about this book of Judges. When that had occurred, it was not exactly to be the purpose of God that Israel at that time would put their swords in their sheaths and think that's it. And I'd like to suggest that when we come to the book of Judges, although we're picking up some negative exhortations, I'd like to suggest that the principle of warfare was very much laid down in the book of Deuteronomy and in the book of Joshua, and it's reinforced for us in the book of Judges. And for us, it's there in type at the very least. We start our minds to think, and brother, as we say, Brother Jim has started our minds along this pattern that Joshua had achieved the greatest victory. So Christ has achieved the greatest victory. Hebrews 2:14, for as much as he was partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil. Christ obtained the great victory over sin. But has he finished? Or has everything been done for us? I think in our various discussions around the Ecclesiastes and in the exhortations we've had so far, we recognize there is a great battle that you and I have to face. Warfare is a principle that is laid down in the scriptures. From Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent would play out that great battle in manifested individuals, in nations, but also in individual lives and in our lives, brethren and sisters. I'd like just to remind us of one or two verses which have been brought to our attention already. Judges 1 and verse 3 we read, Judah said unto Simeon his brother, come up with me into my lot that we may fight against the Canaanites. This was the spirit that Yahweh required in them, that we may fight against the Canaanites. Chapter 3 verse 10. The spirit of Yahweh came upon Othniel and he judged Israel and went out to war. Verse 16, Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges of a cubit length. He was going to slay Eglon, the man of flesh. It is true that Israel had the opportunity to achieve total victory over their enemies, which would have led to ultimate rest and peace. But I think the lessons are there, brethren and sisters, in what is written down for us in the book of Judges, to enable us to realize that total victory, total success, total peace will come when the Lord Jesus Christ returns. So what went wrong? Brother Jim has provided for us the key. He said that there was failure on Israel's part through compromise. The book of Judges tells us just how that fighting spirit that Joshua had was absent to a large degree from those who followed after. They allowed the Canaanites to dwell with them. The verses in chapter 1 are significant. They did not utterly drive them out. They dwelt among the Canaanites until such a time that some of the tribes were even forced into the mountains and were not allowed to come down. These were sin powers, brethren and sisters, which Joshua saw clearly, but which the successive generation failed to perceive. The chapters that we are basing our exhortation on are chapters 4 and 5. The issues of Sisera and the faithfulness of Deborah and Barak. And we read in chapter 5 and verse 8 that Israel chose new gods. Then was war in the gates. Was there a shield or spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? This was the song of Deborah as she commemorated the great victory and the circumstances which had led up to the great victory itself. True, as Brother Jim brought out to us, sin had indeed brought suffering, great suffering upon the people of Israel. And this was their sin. They chose new gods. That word choose, we understand from looking up a concordance, means to try or to select. Brother Dan gave us an exhortation yesterday and asked us each to consider our own individual lives to determine what our own individual stumbling blocks are. Our own individual gods. But here was the children of Israel actually selecting, trying it out. I think as we look at the book of Judges, we're getting a terrific lesson, brethren and sisters, in recognizing our warfare against the battle of sin in our members, both internally and externally. But we have choices. The children of Israel appeared here to make a deliberate choice to serve new gods, other gods. They chose them, they selected them. Brethren and sisters, we are responsible when we put ourselves in the way of sin. I think Brother Thomas makes a great deal of this in Elpis Israel. You know, he says, sin is our nature, the sin that we have in our flesh is our misfortune, not our crime. But when we put ourselves in the position of sin, then we are responsible for it. These people of Israel chose new gods. Isn't this the difficulty all the time with human nature? It was a difficulty that is seen in different ways throughout the scriptures, even to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17. They spent their time in nothing else but learning some new thing. Brethren and sisters, we've got the truth. We have to maintain it in its purity, as Brother Dan exhorted us yesterday. And we have to recognize the great battle of sin that we have to engage in. We know this as well. Then was war in the gates. They chose new gods. Did it help them? No, it did not. And does it help us, brothers and sisters, when we stray from the path, whether in principle or in our conduct? It provides us with trouble and difficulties. Brother Ben reminded us, as I couldn't help thinking when Brother Ben gave the lecture on Monday about the promises of Abraham and having rule of the gates of his enemies. Here they chose new gods, then there was war in the gates. Brother Ben explained to us that the gate of a city was the key position of government and authorities where every decision was made. It was the lifeblood, as it were. And when they chose new gods, they lost control. They lost control over their cities. They lost control over everything. And I think, brothers and sisters, we are being given lessons to show the danger of sin. We've all felt it, haven't we? When we strayed from that path, that straight and narrow path. And I think it's significant that it says, was there a shield or spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? They had no weapons to engage in warfare. They'd lost the battle. They'd lost the battle. They had capitulated to the enemy, to the Canaanite, to the sin power, and were suffering as a result. Yahweh allowed the nations to get the upper hand in the lives of the children of Israel. Just as he sent strong delusion, as we read in 2 Thessalonians 2, that men and women would believe a lie. Why? Because they received not the love of the truth. How careful we have to be, brethren and sisters, to stick closely to the principles of the truth. So when we look at Judges 4 and 5 then, and I presumed that when I was given this particular subject, it was the kind of ideas surrounding Judges 4 and 5 that we were to spend some of our time remarking upon. What are the lessons that we can give in practical terms for us in our daily lives? I think the first one, brothers and sisters, is, and I've already mentioned this, but is to recognize that there will always be a warfare. That we will always be engaged in a battle. But we have to recognize that. Sin is so deceitful that we sometimes fail to recognize the problems it can bring. I often think of Exodus, when the children of Israel were coming out from the land of Egypt, and they were thirsty and they needed sustenance, they needed water, and God provided that water, and then the Amalekites turned up on the scene. As soon as the children of Israel found that water provided from the rock, when Moses smote the rock, the Amalekites turned up and started battling for it. It's another lesson that when the water of life is found, and we have found that water of life, then the battle against the flesh, which Amalek symbolized, begins. It is a battle, brethren and sisters, for our hearts and minds. Just like to quote from the Psalms. In Psalm 106 we read that the children of Israel did not destroy the nations concerning whom Yahweh commanded them, but were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. Learned their works. Jeremiah, we read it a couple of days ago, said, learn not the way of the heathen. In our battle, brethren and sisters, we have to recognize that the world is our enemy, not our friend. The world seems such a nice place. We can become very comfortable in it. But the way of the world must be recognized as our greatest enemy. We listened to a taped address by an old Berean brother when we were coming here. And he spent his time on the subject, he that overcometh. He said that the word meant to conquer. Brothers and sisters, this again emphasizes our great trial in conquering the flesh. in striving to overcome. The children of Israel compromised in that warfare of their faith. We too could be guilty of the same. In Judges chapter 4, we read in verse 2, Yahweh sold the children of Israel into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. They had chosen new gods, so Yahweh in effect said, okay, go ahead. If that's the selection you want to make, then go ahead. Yahweh sold them. It means to sell into slavery, if we looked up in some of the concordances. They became slaves to Jabin, king of Canaan. The Canaanites, as we know, were steeped in idolatry, superstition, and immorality. And the children of Israel were sold into slavery to those people. It's perhaps difficult for us to imagine what that might have been in practical terms, but each one of us is fully aware of the superstition and idolatry and immorality that surrounds us daily. The children of Israel had the opportunity to destroy all this. Instead, they chose it. And so God sold them to it. You know, when Israel were going through the wilderness, they lusted after flesh, and God gave it to them until it was coming out of their nostrils. If we desire a certain path in life, brethren and sisters, then sometimes God will allow us to take that path. If we allow ourselves to compromise, then sometimes we could find ourselves going along paths which are difficult to retrace. Peace and rest comes upon those who serve Yahweh, not Canaan, not sin. As we said earlier, Christ has destroyed the greatest enemy in himself. He has overcome the diabolos, but there is still much for us to do in the great warfare of faith. Verse 12 of chapter 5 incidentally says, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, utter a song, arise, Barak, and lead thy captivity captive, thou son of Abinoam. Paul in Ephesians picks up those very words to refer to the great work of Christ in delivering us from sin. But each one of us knows that that battle against the diabolos continues on a day-by-day basis. As Brother Roberts once remarked in one of his exhortations, the old man has been put to death in the waters of baptism, and yet that old man is very much alive in each one of us. Verse 13, then he made him that remaineth have dominion over the nobles among the people. Yahweh made me have dominion over the mighty. The faithfulness of Deborah and Barak and Jael enabled them to have dominion with the people of Israel. Isn't it a paradox, brethren and sisters, that to gain dominion we have to serve? Those who seek to obtain dominion by their own means will find that they will be defeated. Just as the children of Israel, brethren and sisters, were defeated and lost the upper hand which they should have had. I'd just like to quote from the Epistle of Paul to the Romans in chapter 6 and verse 16. Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness. We have the choice, brothers and sisters, to give our lives in service to God or in the service of sin. The exhortation that we see developing in the book of Judges is that we must give our service to Yahweh. We cannot compromise with sin. I think that's one of the exhortations that Brother Jim has firmly put into our minds on Monday. We cannot compromise with sin. And he quoted Brother Thomas, didn't he? He says, to contemplate upon the lawfulness of compliance is partly to give consent. We cannot for a moment allow our guard to be down. When it is, we suffer. Sin gets the upper hand and can wreak havoc and misery in our lives. We must see sin, brethren and sisters. We must see the world and all that it contains and the things which appeals to the natural man as our enemy, which we must defeat. Warfare is the principle, brethren and sisters, as we said at the outset, that is laid down by God here, for us in type at least, that we must engage in. Judges 4 verse 1 says, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh when Ehud was dead. Yes, this compromise with sin, this failure to eradicate the enemy again and again manifested itself. And many lost their lives as a result. But we notice the chapter contains with us the positive warfare of some. We notice in verse 18, Jael went out to meet Sisera and said unto him, turn in, my lord, turn in to me. Fear not. And when he had turned in unto her, into the tent, she covered him with a mantle. We know the sequel, brethren and sisters. But the point that we wanted to draw attention to is the fact that Jael took positive action in the great fight against sin. I think this is the kind of thing that comes out, the contrast that we see in the book of Joshua to the book of Judges. In the book of Joshua, Joshua had the upper hand in the great battle against the sin powers. In the book of Judges, Israel was on the back foot. And here we see individuals like Jael taking the lead, perhaps. She went out, and said to Sisera, turn in. Jael did something positive in the great battle against sin. We've got to take this attitude, brethren and sisters. We've got to see it as such. She took a deliberate action to accomplish the purpose that she had in her mind. She didn't wait. She positively engaged in a warfare in the way that she could. When we read in verse 21, Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent and took an hammer in her hand and went softly into Sisera and smote the nail into his temples and fastened it into the ground. What a lesson, brethren and sisters. Here was the head of this sin power, this king of Canaan, who came in unto the tent, and Jael takes the peg and with a hammer smashes it through his skull. She smote sin right at its source, in typical terminology. This was the great sin power, brothers and sisters, that was now prostrate before her. I think, brothers and sisters, we are given a powerful exhortation in the great warfare. We have to get at its source. We have to get at the very source of that which can get us into trouble. Our thoughts and the intents of our heart, which can either be acceptable to God or not. This was a deliberate action. She struck him and smote him. She struck at the source of sin sinking. Doesn't this remind you, brethren and sisters, of that warfare that was pronounced in Genesis 3:15, which we refer to? That the seed of the woman would ultimately destroy the seed of the serpent in the head. We read some days ago of the great battle of David and Goliath. He too cut off Goliath's head and took it to Jerusalem, where the greater battle against sin would be accomplished, and when victory would be manifested, even that great event, the greatest event of history, the crucifixion of Christ, when he showed that great victory over sin. That too was a means of service. Victory was obtained at that time. He gained dominion where Adam had failed, but it was gaining dominion by serving Yahweh. We notice the contrast in chapter 5 this chapter in Judges, in verse 15. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah, even Issachar, and also Barak. He was sent on foot into the valley. For the divisions of Reuben, there were great thoughts of heart. Why abodest thou among the sheepfolds to hear the bleatings of the flocks? For the divisions of Reuben, there was great searchings of heart. It seems as if Reuben contemplated the issues. Reuben contemplated the battle, but didn't really commit. They thought about it, they turned it over in their minds, they contemplated upon the lawfulness of compliance, to use Brother Thomas's words again, but they didn't really commit themselves. Gilead abode beyond Jordan, and why did Dan remain in ships? Bob says many excuses, brethren and sisters, that we can make, which hinder us from the great battle that we have. Asher continued on the seashore on a board in his breeches. There seemed to be many of the tribes, brethren and sisters, who were just too apathetic to engage in the warfare, too comfortable with their own individual lives to engage in the warfare of faith. But Zebulun and Naphtali were a people that jeoparded their lives unto the death in the high places of the field. And there were others who were prepared to give up their lives in this warfare of faith. What about you and me, brethren and sisters? Are we prepared to give up our lives in this warfare of faith? Are we prepared to commit to the battle? Or do we hold back? Or do we compromise and justify ourselves? We have to evaluate for ourselves. You and I have to give our individual answers. And one day, we know, we will give an account. In the guidance notes of this address, this exhortation, it was written, God will provide for those who love him. And in this chapter, brethren and sisters, we find that Yahweh did provide. Sisera had a vast army. As we've read, was there a shield or spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? Yeah, Reuben might have had great reasons for holding back. You know, there was all these chariots. It was a formidable form. It was going to be a hard battle at the very least. But the likes of Deborah, Barak, and Jael did not contemplate the difficulties. They put their trust in God. And did he provide? We know that he did. Deborah in verse 6, she sent and called Barak the son of Abinoam out of Kadesh Naphtali and said unto him, Hath not Yahweh Elohim of Israel commanded, saying, Go and draw toward Mount Tabor and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun? I will draw thee to the river Kishon, Sisera, the captain of Jabez's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thine hand. I will deliver him. Whatever message had come, Deborah placed great confidence in Yahweh. She knew that it was not possible, with not even spears and swords, to be able to defeat this terrific chariot-led army. From a natural point of view, the odds were just too great. It wasn't possible. Flesh could not overcome this. This was a great battle that needed Yahweh at the helm. And we read in verse 14, Deborah said unto Bigger, up, for this is the day in which Yahweh hath delivered Sisera into thine hand. It was placing confidence in Yahweh. And I think we are given the lesson, brethren and sisters, that while we have to engage in the warfare of faith, while we have to have the great courage and faith and recognize the great enemy of sin within and the enemy without, we also have to recognize that we cannot do it alone. We cannot do it on our own. Judges 5 verse 4 says, Yahweh, when thou wentest out of Seir, when thou marchest out of the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped, the clouds also dropped water. The mountains melted from before Yahweh, even from Sinai, from before Yahweh, Elohim of Israel. Deborah recognized what God had done in the past and had placed her confidence in him that he could do it and would do it again. And we know the outcome. There was a great destruction upon Sisera's host. They fought from heaven. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. The river of Kishon swept them away. That ancient river, the river Kishon. O my soul, thou hast trodden down strength. It wasn't possible for Deborah, Barak, Jael to do it on their own. But with God's help, they would be victorious. Isn't that a great lesson for us, brethren and sisters, in all our weaknesses? Sometimes perhaps we feel too weak to encounter the enemy. Sometimes we feel the battle is too great for us, that our failures are prohibiting us continuing. I think, brethren and sisters, that the lesson of the judges not only show us failure through compromise, not only show us of a great need to engage in battle, but provides great encouragement for us to get into that battle. And if we have perhaps fallen down, to get up and re-engage. I found it a terrific amount of inspiration in looking at Barak. Barak was nervous about this. Barak said unto Deborah, well, if thou wilt go with me, then I will go. But if thou wilt not go with me, then I will not go. There's no doubt in the faithfulness of Barak. Wasn't he mentioned in Hebrews? He was one of those giants of faith. He led forth that army. But he was stung into action, wasn't he, by Deborah? That is the meaning of her name, Deborah, a bee or wasp. There's also a great deal of encouragement, brothers and sisters, that we can find and obtain from sisters. Don't think we can ever underestimate the power of our sister wives, of our sisters in the truth, who can sometimes provide the necessary stimulus and inspiration for us to engage and re-engage in the warfare of faith. But Barak himself gain strength. And I think, brothers and sisters, doesn't that provide us with encouragement at the times perhaps when we feel in need of strength and encouragement? And in a sense, we're all here together under the high grounds, under the tabernacles, to gain that necessary strength to go on. With each one of us, perhaps, Deborah's in our own right, providing inspiration by our very presence, by the conversations that we have around the truth to one another. We're inspiring one another. We become jaded, don't we? I'm sure we feel that we could have a high just every month to get us inspired and get us going again. I think the lesson that we have here in our warfare against the Diabolos is one which is encouraging when we think of Barak. The other lesson that was suggested for us in our considerations is that we must submit to his righteous rule. We must submit. Righteousness, brothers and sisters, is the key there. We must submit to his righteous rule. Deborah dwelt under the palm tree. We read in Judges 4, verse 5. The palm tree we know is an upright tree. We once heard of someone telling us in the land of Israel, where some of the Palestinians or the Arabs there who were trying to make life easy for themselves had actually bent over a palm tree so that they didn't have to work to get the fruit off the top of it, and the palm tree just went straight back up as it grew. So even though they kind of bent it down, the palm tree was bent on going up. It was determined to grow upwards towards the sky, towards heaven, and to bear fruit in the head. There's a great lesson for us, brethren and sisters. If we're going to submit to God's rule, we must recognize that it is a righteous rule. We don't make up the rules ourselves. We have to recognize the principles of uprightness before we can submit to them. In Judges 5 verse 9, Deborah sings, "My heart is towards the governors of Israel that offered themselves willingly among the people. Bless ye Yahweh." They offered themselves willingly. We know that that is a key to acceptable worship. Brothers and sisters, we're all here because we willingly have come. We didn't have to come. We didn't have to, did we? We've taken vacation. We could have taken it someplace else. So we've come willingly, in a sense, to offer ourselves among the people. Let us continue that in our daily lives. Let us continue to offer ourselves willingly in the service of God's truth and in the battle that we each have to engage in. There is perhaps one final thought that we have in considering the land having rest. Rest is obviously a good thing. We each have our daily rest in the natural order of things in our days of mortality. And it was good for Israel to receive rest from the oppression of Jabin, king of Canaan. But rest can sometimes be a danger in itself. There was a general of NATO who wrote a book some years ago, which I read. It was called The Bear at the Back Door. It was a warning against Russia, and particularly as Russia at that time was trying to take control of some of the shipping paths in South Africa. And the general wrote in the book, he said, "Peace is the most ruthless creature in the world. Peace is the most ruthless creature in the world. One must fight for it all the time." And I've often thought about those words. His basic premise was, yeah, we're in a time of peace, but you've got to fight to maintain it. Once the fight stops, as far as he was concerned, the Russians would get the upper hand. And so he was encouraging those who would read his works to ensure that they kept their military in tip-top condition, sort of thing. But I thought that's so applicable to ourselves. Sometimes in life we have periods where it can be really difficult and we are really engaging in a warfare, and we keenly feel that warfare. We really feel the difficulties of life. And sometimes it's not the warfare against sin, perhaps it's just daily living, perhaps making ends meet. When are we going to pay the next bill? Or how are we going to get through this period of time when children are young, perhaps, and give a sleepless night, and everything seems a battle? And then sometimes in our lives we get past those periods. The children grow up, maybe we're able to pay the bills more easily, we're able to do things, and life becomes smooth. It's perhaps at those times when the land had rest, it's perhaps at those times when we also need to be sure that we are fighting still, that we are fighting to maintain the rest and peace that ultimately will come in God's kingdom. Peaceful periods, brothers and sisters, are not always conducive to spiritual development. Those of us perhaps who are suffering in trials and tribulations, perhaps known only personally to ourselves, can perhaps at least take comfort that we are engaged in that warfare if we are putting our efforts to overcome. But in times of prosperity, as we've been considering in some measure in Ecclesiastes, God can be overlooked. We can become self-satisfied and self-confident. Yeshurun waxed fat and kicked, we read prophetically in Deuteronomy. They sacrificed unto devils, to gods whom they knew not. And that seems to be the refrain, doesn't it, in the book of Judges. When things went quiet, they chose new gods. They dabbled in sin instead of engaging in that warfare. Purity must be maintained, brothers and sisters, in doctrine and in practice, as Brother Dan reminded us yesterday, and fought for until the ultimate rest in the kingdom of God. In the concluding verses of that chapter, we read those beautiful words which finished the song of Deborah. So let all thine enemies perish, O Yahweh. Sisera had been slain, his army defeated. And in the great type, brethren and sisters, we know that ultimately sin will be defeated. All Yahweh's enemies, including sin and its consequences, will be destroyed, will perish. But let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might. What a wonderful figure. What a wonderful analogy. The sun as it arises in the dawn, dispelling the darkness of the night, the warfare being over. Let those that love Yahweh be as the sun when he goeth forth. Or as the psalmist records in Psalm 19, among them he sets a habitation for the sun, who is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. We, brethren and sisters, are waiting for the Son of Righteousness to arise with healing in his beams. We are waiting for he who said, peace I leave with you, not as the world giveth I unto you. He is able, brethren and sisters, to give us the mental peace now, the mental rest now, and in that great day to come. Great peace or rest have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them.